You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Dean Knetter. Coming up, Governor Evers rolled out a new clean energy plan this week. We take a look at some of what's in the plan and compare it with plans in other states.
Now, there's a lot of variety in the world of brownies. You can keep it simple or get really creative.
On this week's edition of Food Friday, our guest has lots of ideas for making great brownies and blondies with different textures and flavors.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you make brownies from scratch, or do you have a favorite boxed mix you go with? What's your favorite brownie recipe? What makes the perfect brownie for you? Fudgy? Cakey? Which do you like the most? Call 800-642-1234. What's the best brownie you ever had? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Leah Hislop is a food and lifestyle editor and writer and deputy editor at Waitrose Food Magazine. Her books include Made in London and her latest, The Brownie Diaries, My Recipes for Happy Times, Heartbreak, and Everything in Between. Leah, welcome to Central Time.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Leah, you say right at the top of your book that you can basically mark out the passage of time in your life with brownie memories. Can you talk a little bit about why you love brownies so much and why you see them as a good dessert?
Of course. I mean, I think they've kind of got a special place in the hearts of lots of us, haven't they, really? I think they're kind of a unique thing in baking. I always think that they're kind of like indulgent and treaty, but also kind of really homely and comforting at the same time. And there's not many things that do that. And I just love their versatility. I think you can kind of, you know, have them really simple, or you can kind of dress them up really fancy. If you're a keen cook, they're just like an amazing blank canvas for you to do whatever you want with them. So I love them. And yeah, when I started writing this book, I felt that I could kind of look back through life and see lots of moments where brownies had made a difference.
One key decision to make when you're making brownies is, do you want them dense and fudgy or a little more fluffy and cakey? First of all, what is it in our recipe and our cooking style that makes the difference between those two things?
It's a kind of combination of things, but in general, it's kind of proportion of chocolate, sugar, fat, really, in comparison to flour. So a cakey brownie will have be a little bit less indulgent on the chocolate and the butter, and it will probably have more flour in it, so it's got a bit more of kind of gluten structure going on. It can also be a bit to do with how long you cook them. I love both styles, actually. Like, people get very very opinionated on the subject of fudgy versus cakey, but you know, I think there's a place for all of them.
And Leah, I understand from your book that one American icon that had very clear feelings on at least flour content in brownies was Katharine Hepburn.
Oh, yeah. Katharine Hepburn was a big fan of the brownie, which I really enjoy as a piece of trivia. And there's just this great story about her meeting someone and writing them a little note, which gave them some advice for life. And I can't quite remember exactly what it was, but it was like, number one, be yourself. Number two, something, something. Number three, don't put too much flour in your brownies, which I really enjoy. And it's good advice.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Leah Hislop about her new cookbook, The Brownie Diaries, My Recipes for Happy Times, Heartbreak, and Everything in Between. You can join in with your favorite brownies or your brownie-related questions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Lisa is with us in Madison. Lisa, hi.
Hi. I make a brownie. It's a very dense brownie, and then once that's cool, I make a homemade caramel sauce that thickens up when it cools. I pour that over the brownie. And then when that's cool, I whip up a homemade batch of marshmallows and I pour that over. And that's like a good inch and a half thick marshmallow on top of all that. And then drizzle that with some of the caramel sauce and chocolate. And it is really good.
Well, you had me with that brownie with caramel, marshmallow and chocolate on top of it. Is this something you make all the time, Lisa, or is this your like special occasion brownies?
Well, I only used to make it once in a while, and now I have people requesting it, and you can't eat it. You know, you have to cut them small because they're very rich, but they are just the best.
Oh, I'll cut them as big as I want. Lisa, thanks for that. Now, in your book, Leah, you offer a lot of different toppings and other things that can go into or on top of brownies. What are some of your favorite combos?
Oh yeah, I mean, when you've got to develop 52 brownie recipes for a book, you go pretty mad by the end of it. So I've got all sorts of things. I've got one of my favorites is one that's kind of inspired by Scotland. So it's got kind of bits of fudge in it, bits of shortbread,
some haggis, and a good. Oh no, wait.
Yeah, a bit of absolutely no. I'm joking. good splash of whiskey though. And then I've got my hangover brownies, which are maple syrup and bacon, which is, you know, classic combo. But yeah, there's everything in there, really, from the weird to the wonderful.
And Leah, you passed us along a few recipes. We have those up on our website at wpr.org/foodfriday. And let's start with classic 101. This is in, you know, the section of your book, Brownies for Every Day, the ultimate fudgy brownies. What are the secrets to putting this together?
Yeah, so this is kind of, yeah, the sort of first recipe in the book. It's my blueprint, and I do love it very dearly. It took me a long time to get to kind of the point where I was completely happy with it. So my kitchen was just full of chocolate and, you know, crumbs for weeks while I tried to get my head around it. But in the end, it's, you know, it's super fudgy. So there's a lot of chocolate in it, about 300 grams, plenty of sugar. Eggs. I always add an extra. I quite often add an extra egg yolk because it just kind of adds a little bit of extra richness. And I often do a mix of flour and cocoa powder because you might think you don't need cocoa powder if you've got melted chocolate in a brownie, but actually it kind of brings another dimension of chocolatiness to it. I always think a kind of deeper flavor. So I quite often have a little bit of that. And you can do that at home if you have a recipe that's usually flour. If you swap a bit out for cocoa powder, I think it makes a difference.
You can find that recipe and a couple others at wpr.org/foodfriday. Okay, Leah, I usually make my brownies in a rectangular glass, you know, baking dish. You go square. Oh, talk about your favorite kind of brownie baking tin.
Yeah, I go square. I find it just kind of a nice, manageable size. And I use at home, I use a loose bottom tin because I find that really useful. You know, you're not kind of like trying to prize it out of a tin where it's stuck. And I always recommend using a metal tin, preferably a kind of pale metal tin. I find it cooks a bit more evenly than glass or ceramic. Not quite sure of the science of that, but I tend to find you get a better result with a metal tin.
And Leah, you lay out a few kind of four key steps, four key elements to making a brownie. Could you walk us through those? What are sort of the core elements of making a brownie if we're thinking about it very simply?
Yeah, well, if you think about a cake, you know, usually you start by creaming butter and sugar together and that gets kind of airy and you get that light fluffiness. You don't want to do that with a brownie, right? You want kind of dense fudge a lot of the time. So instead, it starts in a different way where you're melting butter and chocolate together. After that, you're kind of adding your sugar and your eggs. I quite often use a beater once I've put the eggs in. I find if you give it a good kind of whiz, it tends to help get that kind of lovely crust on top, you know, that kind of beautiful, crackly, crinkly top you get on really nice brownies. So I often do that. And then last but not least, you're folding in your flour and your cocoa if you're using it. And you do that pretty gently. Oh, and that's a good time to add some salt as well. I always think salt makes a lot of difference to brownies.
We heard on the Ideas Network Facebook page from Marsha, who writes, "My favorite brownie is a from-scratch recipe that's more of a baked fudge, beyond rich." And Marsha says, "My first baking experience was a blondie recipe I learned in home economics class." Is there a magical dividing line, Leah, between fudge and a really fudgy brownie?
Magical dividing line. That's a good question. Depends how long you bake it, I think, a lot of the time. I always recommend fridging my brownies, which not everyone does. But if you like fudginess, it kind of just firms it up. Somehow you put a kind of squishy brownie in the fridge and it goes kind of firm and very fudge-like. Again, the science of that is a mystery to me, but I really recommend it. That's easier to cut as well.
It's Food Friday. Leah Hislop is with us. Her new cookbook is called The Brownie Diaries, My Recipes for Happy Times, Heartbreak, and Everything in Between.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What are your favorite variations on the brownie? How about blondies? What brownie successes or failures have you had in the kitchen? Our guest is here to help you troubleshoot and get some ideas for spicing it up with brownies in the kitchen. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Dean Kinnetter. Right now, we're picking up our Food Friday talk about brownies with Leah Hislop, author of the new cookbook, The Brownie Diaries, My Recipes for Happy Times, Heartbreak, and Everything in Between.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite style of brownie, a favorite brownie you've ever eaten, whether it was homemade, restaurant bought, or whatever? Do you have a question about how to make the best brownies? Are you baking some right now? I see ya. Tell us about them. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Leah, something that I've had to work on in my brownie game over time is how to tell when they're done. How they're fudgy but not raw. What tips do you have for us on telling when a brownie is done?
That is the ultimate challenge, isn't it? I think it takes practice. But I would say, first of all, get to know your oven. Does it run a bit hotter? Does it run a bit cooler than other ovens? Always recommend getting a temperature checker if you can. And if you know that your oven runs a bit hot, I would recommend you start checking maybe like 5 to 10 minutes before the recipe says, you know, it's going to be ready. You know, it's not like a cake. It's not going to sink. So it's safe to check. So that's a good tip. I usually take mine out when they have a tiny bit of movement still in the tin. You know, when you kind of shake it and there's just a little bit of jiggle in the center, because mm-hmm. they continue cooking as you take them out. So that's a good tip for me. And you know, the skewer test that you use for cakes, it's doesn't quite work for brownies, but you can still do a skewer test. So if you put it in and you're getting kind of liquid batter, you know, that's not ready. If you put it in and it's dry, you've kind of overdone it. But if you're getting kind of like crumbs, you know, like chocolate crumbs, kind of moist chocolate crumbs stuck to it, I think that's usually a good moment for me to think that's probably about ready.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Joe is with us in Madison. Joe, hello.
Hi, I have a quick two-part question. Has the guest ever heard of America's Test Kitchen? They have a recipe for a triple chocolate chip cookie, which I've used for years. And if you make it thicker, no one would know it wasn't a brownie. So the second question is, what is the difference really between a good chocolatey or fudgy, even chocolate chip cookie versus a double chocolate or triple chocolate cookie versus a brownie? And any thoughts on America's Test Kitchen? Thank you.
Joe, thanks for the call. We've talked to America's Test Kitchen a time or five on the show. Leah, thoughts on that border between a really chocolatey fudgy cookie and a really fudgy brownie?
I have heard of America's Test Kitchen. I don't know it well, but that is a good question, isn't it? I think often people refer to brownies as, in the US anyway, you guys refer to them as bar cookies a lot, which I think is an interesting phrase. We don't really have that in the UK. But I think it's about kind of, I mean, for me, it's just a question of kind of depth, isn't it? Like, I think a cookie is, you get a lot more surface, right? You get that kind of, the crust is kind of a lot of the main event. Whereas a brownie, I think you get that squidgy depth. Still the crust on top, but it's kind of a smaller part. So I suppose that's how I think about it. I'm not quite sure what the scientific difference would be. The America's Test Kitchen would probably have a better answer for that.
We mentioned blondies just before the break, and Leah, you passed us along a recipe that we have up at WPR.org/Food Friday for first day on the job blondies. Can you tell us about these?
Oh, yeah. So this idea was that you start a new job and, you know, what do you want to do? You probably want to take something along that you can share out and, you know, win some new friends with. So that I designed a blondie for that. So something that you can carry, that it's, you know, it's not going to disintegrate, carries well in a Tupperware, and that most people are going to like. So it's a kind of a classic white chocolate blondie, but it's gently spiced with kind of like chai spices. So kind of like ginger, cinnamon, cardamom, love those flavors. And then it's got little squares of milk chocolate studded on the top as well. So you get that mix of milk and white chocolate, which I think is really nice and balances out the sweetness. It's probably my favorite recipe in the book, actually.
Again, you can find that at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. We've got David with us in Oshkosh. Hi, David.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you want to tell us about your brownie habits, David?
I just love to make sure the edges are right. You know, I mean, you got to get the edges perfectly, not crisp, but just chewy, you know? And then I love putting marijuana in my brownies. I don't know if you guys do.
David, thanks for the call. We'll leave no comment on that one. But Leah, getting the edges of our brownies right, what do you think?
I'm going to say metal tin again. I'm going to sound like a broken record, but I really think that helps. It kind of conducts the heat enough, so you're going to get it. It just helps. Trust me. Metal tin all the way.
And earlier we were talking about some of the ways in your book that you get really creative with brownies. One thing that stuck out to me is there is a popcorn brownie in the book, Leah. Could you tell us, how can we incorporate popcorn into a brownie?
Oh, yeah. I was being slightly silly with that one. That's called my Netflix and chili brownie. So it's it's designed to be, you know, to have on the sofa on a date. So it's popcorn and chili kind of mixed in. I mean, popcorn works really well in brownies. I usually chop a bit and then mix it through the batter. And then once it's in the tin, I push popcorn into the top as well. You want to use that kind of crunchy toffee popcorn. I don't know what you call it in the US. But yeah, you want to use that stuff because it kind of does make sure it doesn't go soggy.
All right, we've got one more recipe you shared with us at WPR.org/Food Friday. This is, now we had the first day on the job, Blondie. Now this is the Lonesome Tonight Brownies. So first of all, before we get to the recipe, what goes into your mind when you want a Lonesome Tonight brownie? What are you shooting for there?
I was just thinking, you know, like brownies are very cheering, aren't they? Like, I think they are one of those foods that just always cheers you up. So I wanted a recipe that was, you know, perfect for those days where, I don't know, you know, you've had a breakup or you've had a bad day at work and you just want comfort. But you also probably don't want to go to the shops, crucially. So it's kind of got lots of store cupboard stuff in it. Oreos and peanut butter, which I think, you know, the two comforting things in the cupboard, aren't they, at all times? So that's that one. It's very indulgent. But, you know, that's what you need.
We're talking with Leah Hislop right now, author of the new book, The Brownie Diaries, My Recipes for Happy Times, Heartbreak, and Everything in Between. Leah, we talked about tips on how to find out when a brownie is done, ready to take out of the oven. What are some other roadblocks, common mistakes that people should be watching out for?
That's a good question. Obviously, yeah, so taking out at the right time is, I think, the big one that a lot of people stumble upon. Using the right kind of chocolate, I think, is pretty crucial. I mean, I tend to use, and most of my recipes use, what we call here kind of like 70% dark chocolate. So pretty dark. And I just think that does give the best chocolatey flavor. Using kind of milder chocolate, I don't know why, but it just doesn't, yeah, like milk chocolate, I love, but it just doesn't have the same impact in a brownie. So I would say, yeah, using good ingredients is kind of crucial. Salt, which I mentioned earlier, doesn't really make it taste salty, but if you just put, even if you can, you know, health allowing, if you just put 1/4 teaspoon in a batch, it just kind of makes all the flavors come together really nicely.
Now, Leah, Dean made some brownies yesterday and brought them in, but actually, you didn't make them yourself. Somebody else, but you were the transporter. True.
Yes.
Anyway, that's not the point. The point is, one of our colleagues couldn't eat them because she's got to be gluten-free. You've got an answer for that. What are the keys to making a gluten-free brownie that people still want to eat?
Yeah, I've got a few recipes in the book for those kind of tricky moments. But yeah, gluten-free. I did a lot of testing for this. I tried a lot of different flours. I mean, personally, I find that a lot of the kind of conventionally available gluten-free flours don't do much for me. They've always got a kind of slightly grainy texture. So for me, ground almonds is the secret. Ground almonds work a lot like flour, and they just bring a kind of lovely nuttiness. So I love using those. And the other thing that works well is corn flour, which, you know, I mostly use for kind of like thickening stews and things, but corn flour works quite well as well. It's because it's so fine, I think it doesn't have that grainy feel. So my recipe actually is a mix of ground almonds and corn flour, and that works well for me.
And on the other hand, Leah, are there ways to make a brownie a little bit healthier if we're watching out for that?
Yeah, just about. I mean, I've got a few in the book as well for that. So, I have got one called I Should Eat More Vegetables that has carrots in it, but it also has cream cheese frosting. So I can't really claim that one's much healthier. But yeah, I also have one that it's slightly lower on kind of sugar, butter, all that stuff. And that's got butternut squash in, which works really well. You can't really taste it. I guess it's a little bit like carrots in a carrot cake in that sense. But yeah, it means you just don't have to use quite as much sugar fat, and it gives it a nice kind of, it's got kind of nice moistness to it, which helps in a brownie.
And I've also heard of substitutes like applesauce and I think even black beans in brownies. Is that something you've encountered?
You know, I've tried the beans. I tried chickpeas. I wasn't into it. I could taste it. but maybe it works for some people.
Leah, I gotta ask, I mean, you like brownies, but you've been working on brownies a long time and presumably trying multiple incarnations of all these recipes. Did you hit a brownie wall at some point? Or was like, okay, maybe enough with the brownies for a while?
Oh, yeah, there was a big wall. I mean, I wrote this book during the start of the pandemic. So it was like the first lockdown we had here in the UK. And I just went a bit mad. Just like brownies all over the house. No one I could share them with except my husband. So like, you know, it got to this point where I didn't even know what a brownie was meant to taste like anymore. You know, I'd be like, should it taste like this? Is this right? So yeah, I definitely hit a brownie wall. I didn't eat them for a good 6 months after finishing the book, but thankfully I'm back on the brownie bandwagon now.
And have you gotten to revive some of that social aspect of the brownie? Have you gotten to start sharing them with people again?
I have, which has been really nice. And it's been really nice to see people's reactions and the ones they like. Yeah, because it's such an important part of cooking, isn't it? It's very strange to write a book like this in a vacuum, because food is all about sharing, and brownies especially are about sharing, I think. You know, you don't make them for yourself, do you? They're a tray bake. They're intrinsically shareable.
All right, Leah, it is a drizzly, kind of dismal day in Wisconsin today, or most of Wisconsin anyway. What kind of brownie matches that mood?
Oh, that is a good question. I would probably make what I call my tea and sympathy brownies, which are flavored with a little hint of tea, and they've got biscuits pressed into them. So they are very comforting.
Leah, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today. I appreciate it. That's Leah Hislop, a food and lifestyle editor and writer. Her new cookbook is called The Brownie Diaries, My Recipes for Happy Times, Heartbreak, and Everything in Between. You can find a few recipes from Leah over at WPR.org/Food Friday. We've got we just talked about the Lonesome Tonight brownies, some peanut butter in there, the First Day on the Job blondies, like cardamom and cinnamon in that, and then your basic ultimate fudgy brownies. Okay, Dean, if you had to make one, which one would it be this here weekend?
I'm a bit of a fan of the blondies, Rob. I think I'm going to have to try those First Day on the Job blondies.
You know,
and some days feel like that anyways.
I forget about the existence of blondies, and then I have a blondie, and I'm like, these are really good. So yeah, I think I might go that way too.
Well, I will gladly transport them if they are made.
Start your day with great conversations each weekday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. On Monday, it's the State Capitol Report. Kate talks to Wisconsin's state forester about the health of our trees and our forestry business, plus a talk with Revenue Secretary Peter Barca about Wisconsin's financial picture as tax season wraps up. That's coming up Monday morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kinetter.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Earlier this week, Governor Tony Evers announced a clean energy plan for Wisconsin.
It lays out a list of strategies for achieving goals that will help Wisconsin adapt to and mitigate the effects of climate change.
That includes the target of 100% carbon-free electricity by 2050. Among the other goals, reducing the state's purchases of energy from other states by developing more in-state sources for power and increasing the use of renewable sources. That plan sets goals, but to put many of them into practice, the state legislature would need to sign off on changes.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What is your top priority for energy in Wisconsin? Where should the state be focusing when it comes to energy policy? What should we change, and when should we change it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org.
Fred Beach teaches energy technology policy and international energy policy at the University of Texas, Austin. Fred, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
A lot of states, Fred, have plans of one sort or another to promote renewable energy, to manage their energy grids and more. First of all, can you talk about the role of a state government in setting these kind of priorities for the short and long term?
Actually, in the United States, they're pretty limited. We live in a representative democracy, so most of the voting we do is not so much with the ballot box to get our representatives in there, but it's what we do with our wallet, our pocketbook. Our strongest votes are our actions within the marketplace. So the government can set goals, and the legislature can pass laws that restrict things or encourage things, but it really comes down to what I think the consumer does that matters the most.
Well, if consumers are listening, and I assume most of us consume energy one way or another, what kind of influence can they have as consumers on the energy mix in their community?
I guess by speaking up with their actions. Many of us have the opportunities, depending on our electric provider, to get lower emission energy sources or purchase those. Most of us who have single family homes obviously have the option to put solar panels on our roof or to control the type of heating and cooling we do in our homes, which is influenced by the energy source. And then, of course, there's transportation, which is a whole other sector we can influence.
There is as a fair amount a state can do when it comes to regulations to make it easier or more difficult to do things like, you know, encourage wind or the rooftop solar you just mentioned. What kind of examples would you point toward in states that you think are doing these things well or poorly?
I think one of the strongest things a state can do, and a few states have done, is deregulate their electricity market. Obviously, California did that quite some time ago and went through a lot of learning pains in the process. Texas followed a few years after that, learned from California's mistakes, and other regions have followed. Deregulating the market, giving the market more power, and therefore the consumers more power, I think is a strong step in that direction. I think that is something certainly that the state could do if they chose to, but it'd be a pretty bold move.
You wrote a few years back about Texas's growth in renewable energy sources. Can you talk about the kind of things you've seen there and what you think has helped that happen?
You know, Texas is interesting. We're a very strongly Republican state these days, even though we used to be Democratic. Wind has just been phenomenal in Texas, the way it has grown, and it's had very little to do with the government. Wind reached a point where it was extremely competitive economically, and it took off. You know, in Texas, if it makes economic sense, it happens.
We're talking to Fred Beach from the University of Texas Austin, looking at renewable energy plans by state governments. As he says, they, of course, don't have full control over such things. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you done rooftop solar at your place here in Wisconsin or in a neighboring state? What kind of regulations, what kind of rules did you encounter? What kind of changes do you want to see when it comes to the state's energy policies? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Okay, here in Wisconsin, Fred, we have this this plan, this guideline from Governor Evers. A lot of the practical steps would have to be, you know, involve the legislature probably. As you look at what you're seeing from the governor's office here, what do you make of it?
It's 170 pages that doesn't say much.
How so?
Just some aspirational goals and objectives, but very little on how things are going to evolve. I mean, Wisconsin's in a very difficult position. You have very little wind resource. You have very little solar resource. You're heavily dependent on coal and natural gas in the electricity sector. And I see nothing in that 170 pages speaking to how that's going to change or how it should change, other than it should change.
Well, with wind, for example, we've got neighbors like Iowa, according to the Department of Energy, getting a big chunk of their energy, their electricity, I should say, from wind, over 50%. Wisconsin's not that different than Iowa. Why do you see potential at least for growth in a state like Wisconsin?
Absolutely. I mean, Wisconsin does not have the equivalent wind resource of Iowa, but you do have Lake Michigan, which has excellent wind resource just a few miles offshore. Honestly, I am a little surprised personally that the Wisconsin has not taken greater advantage of the wind resource of the lake and built some significant offshore wind out there. That may have somewhat to do with the fact that, again, you don't have a deregulated market. A couple of very large power providers determine somewhat independently what they offer.
Do you think the state should play a role in saying, yeah, we want to wean ourselves off of coal in particular and then natural gas to fill in the blank with whatever works in the state? Do you see a significant role for the state in charting that course?
I think the best thing the state can do is set standards. And throughout that 170 pages, the plan, the standards I see that the state is aspiring to is low carbon, low emissions. If you want to influence people's behavior, one way to influence their behavior is place a tax on those high fossil fuel, high carbon sources of energy. You know, give people an incentive to do something different. That's kind of that's a stick, not a carrot, but sticks often tend to work better than carrots.
Do you see carrots that might be tasty enough to work?
you know, the best carrot out there to encourage people, if you want to see more rooftop solar, is do a decent net metering plan for people who do it. But there's been huge pushback against that, not only in your state, but in many others around the country, primarily driven by the utilities.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Mac is with us in Milwaukee. Mac, hi.
Hi. I think it's valuable to push back on the narrative that consumer choice is the driving or even only factor in fighting these things. To a huge extent, when we leave everything up to the market, that's essentially allowing the market and the large companies to control it to dictate our actions. Like using the example of transportation, if I'd like to get somewhere in America, if I'd like to have a job, I need to drive a car because there is no government public alternative. I need to buy a car from a private company, put gas in it, and drive somewhere. Like, we subsidize the gas companies and clear out a market for them, and that's how capitalism historically has worked. I think we need strong government regulation and intervention to get these things done.
Mac,
would be my comment.
Mac, thanks for the call. Fred, what do you think?
I agree with the regulation part. Place a carbon tax. Tax gasoline more heavily. If you want to get to work, as you mentioned, in a car, which is hard to do without a car, buy an electric car. And it would be much, it's already economically to your advantage to do so. And yet we see very low penetration so far in the United States.
Thanks for that call, Mac. And Governor Evers's plan also involves hoping for more use of electric vehicles in Wisconsin, both by the government and by individual consumers, maybe like Mac. Do you see a policy device, if that is the goal, to help make that happen?
I don't think a policy device is necessary at this point. Electric cars are actually a better economic choice than fossil fuel vehicles at this point. And in fact, even if, you know, we could wave a magic wand and all folks in your state were driving electric cars tomorrow, it would make your situation even worse because the vast majority of your electricity comes from natural gas and coal.
We're talking to Fred Beach about clean energy plans for states. Governor Tony Evers announced Wisconsin's first one of its kind this week. Fred teaches energy, technology, and policy at the University of Texas, Austin. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see more renewable energies like wind and solar in Wisconsin? If so, how do you think we should get there? Should we have more nuclear in the mix? Just one active plant right now? Do you want to see wind turbines in your community? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Knetter.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Fred Beach. He teaches energy, technology, and policy at the University of Texas, Austin. We're talking about Wisconsin and other states' clean energy plans, detailed and precise, or vague and aspirational. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What would you like to see Wisconsin pursue when it comes to energy policy over the next couple few decades? Are you doing rooftop solar? How does that work out financially for you? Are there things that might make it easier or more difficult for you to make that decision? How about nuclear power? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Fred, we've had conversations on this show in recent months about nuclear power. The case being made that it's a little different these days. You could do smaller plants, more economical plants. Do you see room for that in a renewable energy mix?
I think it's essential, and not so much a renewable energy mix. I mean, what we all really want, I believe, is clean energy, low emission or zero emissions energy. And that is precisely what nuclear is. So, yes, I mean, I'm biased. I'm pro-nuclear. I've served on nuclear-powered submarines and aircraft carriers in the Navy. I'm very familiar and comfortable with the technology. But yes, I think it's an essential part of the energy mix as we try to incorporate more wind and more solar sources.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Rick is with us in Madison. Rick, hi.
Hi. I'm curious. I'm seeing recently that we're building some pretty big solar farms, and we've seen some fairly big wind farms down in especially in Illinois. Why not combine? Why not put windmills on top of solar farms.
Rick, thanks for that call. I imagine it involves where the wind and sun are. Fred, is that something people are doing?
It's very dangerous to do that. We've seen very many cases in the wintertime. You get ice on the blades of wind turbines. And as the blades thaw and that ice comes off, it comes off in a projectile manner. The last thing you want is a large array of solar panels in close proximity to those wind turbines.
That makes sense. Rick, thanks for calling in with the question at 800-642-1234. The governor's plan here also mentions manure digesters. That's something we have some of in Wisconsin. I think there's a bit of that in Texas, too. Do you see this being a significant potential source of electrical generation?
Not a huge source, but an essential part, because anaerobic digesters not only eliminate the methane that would have come from that source and gone into the atmosphere, but use that methane then as a fuel source. So in effect, it's a net zero carbon type way to take what had been a pollutant, the methane, and use it as a fuel source. So no, I think it's a very encouraging thing to see employed at larger scale. It certainly works towards distributed energy solutions.
Let's take another caller now. Matthew is with us in McFarland. Matthew, hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call and discussing this very, very important topic. I'm a building science expert, and I want wondering if the guests can comment on the need for electrification of the building stocks. You know, buildings consume around 40%, and the need to educate future generations of the importance of electrifying buildings and the many other things that we use.
And Matthew, just to be clear, you're talking about using electricity instead of, say, natural gas for heat and cooking?
For heating, yes, absolutely. Instead of natural gas for the heating, which is predominantly up in northern climates, which we need to do, but there are alternatives.
Matthew, thanks for the call. Fred, is that part of the picture?
Absolutely. I mean, people think we're highly electrified in this country. Our electrification has only just begun. You're absolutely right. You live in a very cold climate. The majority of your residential, commercial, industrial heating is via natural gas, which is a very efficient way to heat, but it is not very climate conducive. Heating with electricity is possible through advanced heat pumps. It is much cleaner, but again, it depends on where your electricity is coming from. Again, if I could wave a magic wand tomorrow and everybody in your state had electric heat pumps for heating their homes, it would be a worse situation because that electricity is coming from coal and natural gas power plants. You would have just made the situation worse. So everything has to work together as we talk about these areas where we can improve. They have to be synergistic with what we're doing in the other areas of the energy economy.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking about clean energy and how to get there with Fred Beach from the University of Texas, Austin. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. We've got Linda with us in Appleton now. Linda, hi.
Hi there. Yes, I know there's lots of different types of electrical cars coming out, and I'm wondering if there's a way to have like a universal public, you know, plug in for all the different types of electrical cars. I think that's about it. Thank you.
Linda, thanks.
Every electric car I know of can plug in to standard 115-volt household power. I've owned an electric car for 15 years. I've got nothing fancy in my garage. I just plug it into the standard 115-volt outlet. So there is a standard. It's called the U.S. Electric Grid. What I think you're referring to are some of the other high-power charging options. And yes, there are basically two standards that exist right now, Tesla and not Tesla. But there are adapters that can make those work in either option.
Thanks for that call, Linda. Another question ongoing here in Wisconsin and around the country is, okay, yeah, you could plug in at home. How about on the road? Range, anxiety, that sort of thing. Are you seeing that problem getting solved?
I don't see range anxiety as being a problem. I have yet to meet somebody who actually owns and operates an electric car who has range anxiety. 90% of American miles traveled are commuting, and 90% of those miles are trips of 30 miles or less. So the whole concept of, oh, but I wanted to be able to travel coast to coast, that is such a niche, marginal area of the operation of most automobiles that it's pretty insignificant. So it just bothers me that we get so wrapped up over that concept, which really isn't a problem.
Thanks again for the call, Laura. We'll go to Laura now in Twin Lakes. Laura, hi.
Hi. My question, thank you for taking my call on Happy Earth Day. And my question or comment is if there is any research ongoing as to, when a vehicle moves, it generates wind. And there is the sun to create solar power. So I'm picturing a car with a solar panel and basically a generation of energy from the wind that the vehicle actually creates as it moves. Huh. And that can help recharge the vehicle,
I gotcha, Laura. I never really thought about that. I know some electric vehicles use, when you're braking, I think they generate electricity. Can we use that, the movement of the air or movement through the air and the tops of our cars for solar?
Interesting idea. Unfortunately, as a car moves through the atmosphere, the air, it's actually that resistance, that wind resistance, that air resistance we're fighting against. Mm-hmm. So a car doesn't actually generate on a net basis wind or movement of the air. It only displaces the air as it moves through it, and the air comes back together behind it. What you kind of portrayed actually would have been a perpetual motion machine, fundamentally. So, I mean,
yeah, why don't
it's
we do
an
those?
Interesting idea.
No, just kidding.
Yeah, that'd be nice too. But certainly I see more and more applications of actually putting solar on the roofs and hoods of cars. And even though it seems insignificant, if your car is sitting in the sun in a parking lot for 8 hours while you're at work, that can add a significant amount of range to your car.
Thanks again for that call. Now, I know we talk a lot about wind and solar and nuclear. Are there energy sources or energy storage technologies on the horizon, Fred, that you're watching for that, you know, might not perpetually be 10 years away, but could actually be something we see sooner than that?
One that's ready today and that could be deployed at large scale nationwide is geothermal. It's old technology. We've been drilling holes in the Earth's crust in this country for hundreds of years. And there's a lot of hot water down there. So I think low temperature geothermal is a very promising source of electricity generation that could be employed quite rapidly across the U.S.
Let's go back to our callers. Jim is with us in River Falls. Hi, Jim.
Hi, thanks for taking my comments. So just a couple things. I have like 5 kW of photovoltaics that I added, and also I've got a geothermal heat pump, so that's helped tremendously as far as, you know, not using a lot of power. And I just wish the government would have more incentives and tax rebates for that. I think a lot of those programs have been cut out. So, I mean, that would help people with their budgets quite a bit, too, if everybody could put those on their home. Or, you know, geothermal heat pumps are great as far as being very efficient.
Jim, thanks for the call. We just have a few moments left. Fred, Jim would like to see incentives for people to do what he's doing, geothermal heat pumps and some photovoltaic cells.
Again, that's a way for the government to encourage what we want with those kind of incentives. We've renewed the solar PV incentive a couple of times now, but it, like many incentives, it has a phase out to it unless Congress keeps renewing it. And I think in this case, Congress should.
Thanks for that call, Fred. Just in our last few moments, if you had one message for, I don't know, a Midwestern governor who wants to have a cleaner energy profile in their state, what would it be?
Tax gasoline.
Straightforward. Fred, thanks again for joining us today.
Okay, thank you for having me.
Fred Beach, the professor who teaches energy, technology, and policy at the University of Texas, Austin. We talked to them today about Wisconsin's new clean energy plan, how it compares with what some other states have in the works, and you can keep sharing your thoughts, your comments, maybe your own experiences. You can email ideas@WPR.org, or you can always tweet us @CentralTimeWPR. Again, that's @CentralTimeWPR.
Coming up Monday on Central Time, to find a way out of war, we may need to look back into history and think about why wars start in the first place. We'll talk with the author of the new book, Why We Fight, about the roots of armed conflict and the path to finding peace.
And we'll meet a Waukesha man who's in his 50th year of collecting vintage beer cans with his family, classic Wisconsin collection. We'll find out how he got started and hear about some favorite finds. Hey, if you do this too, send pictures. Email centraltime@WPR.org. That's centraltime@WPR.org. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time.